Bom dia.
Eu vou apresentar o curso em inglês, vou apresentar cada palestrante no idioma deles, para facilitar o palestrante, certo? Acho que todo mundo aqui vai ter uma tradição simultânea em casa. I'm going to be calling soon to the stage Chris Anderson. He is editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. He was nominated for 9 national magazine awards and has won the prestigious top prize for general excellence 3 times. At the end of 2009, Adweek honored this consistent record of success by naming Wired Magazine of the Decade. Chris is author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Long Tail, and Free, The Future of a Radical Prize. In 2007, he was named by Times Magazine as one of the top 100 influential people in the world. He has a Bachelor of Science in Physics from George Washington University and studied quantum mechanics, Big Bang Theory for those of you who know the show, and science journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He was born in London a few years before me, lived in Hong Kong in the 90s, failed out of college, did the punk rock scene, but eventually turned the corner and went back to the university and studied quantum physics. I present to you Chris Anderson.
Now, one of the challenges of broadcast was how do you make money?
in the 1930s and 40s, there were many competitions to determine what should a business model of radio be. And one competition in particular, the 1930s, came up with a series of winners. And the number one, the gold winner suggestion for a business model for radio was a tax on vacuum tubes, a tax on the actual electronics equipment itself. Now, this is considered crazy. Of course, you can never do that, but in fact, that is what the United Kingdom did. In Britain, the BBC is paid for with a tax on radios. You pay when you buy the radio and the television, and pay annually. And your license fee, in fact, is the business model of the BBC. Elsewhere, in the United States and then beyond, the number two winner, the runner-up in this contest, emerged as the model. This was advertising. The notion that you would create a pool of attention with broadcast ability to reach vast audiences, then you would sell that attention to merchants and manufacturers who would market this. That's the way we don't think anything about this. One subtle consequence of this business model, pool of attention business model, is that bigger is better. The way to make money is by distributing your fixed costs, that's your content and your broadcast power, over the widest possible audience. You spread your fixed costs over a large advertising over the largest number of near zero marginal cost viewers. And so we needed to invent a product that could reach, that would be suitable for millions of people. And so we had to invent prime time, and we had to invent the top 40, and we had to invent bestsellers and blockbusters, and we had to invent common culture. And so today, when you look at the culture that we grew up with, what you see is on our prime time, on our soap operas, our prime time shows, and everything we see on television, these are creations. These are products that did not exist before broadcast. They were essentially designed to be a lowest common denominator. They're designed to cut across what we share in terms of our taste. So sports, weather, certain happy, comedy, happy domestic themes. All these kind of things are designed to aggregate huge pools of potential. And that's the world we grew up in, a world of common culture, a world of mass culture, a world where everybody watches the same thing. Now, when I was growing up, in the 1970s in the United States, when I came home from school, I watched a show called Gilligan's Island. It was I hope it never made it here. But it was a show about castaways on an island. And if you looked at the Nielsen ratings of Gilligan's Island in 1976 or so, whatever, when I was watching it, 12-year-old boy, you would have seen that it had 60% market share. 60% of American homes with 12-year-old boys with children of any sort were watching Gilligan's Island and that sort of 4 o'clock time slot. Now, you would have determined, based on the statistics, that this was we had developed the perfect show. We developed the optimal show for 12-year-old boys. The statistics said you had almost 100% penetration of those households. Now, as time went on, we got cable television, and then digital cable television, and then the internet. And I now have a 12-year-old boy. I see that my 12-year-old boy is watching YouTube, and he's watching Lego stop motion animations, and he's watching fail blog, and he's watching skateboarding videos. And we now see the mistake we made. We confused supply with demand. The reason I watched Gilligan's Island is not that it was the best show for me, it was the only show that was on. It was Gilligan's Island and three soap operas. I only had four channels in my home. It was Gilligan's Island and three soap operas. So when you confuse supply with demand, you don't really know what people want. You only know that you offer a limited choice, they will choose from one of those two things. What we have seen over the past decade is the destruction of that model. We've gone from limited choice to unlimited choice. And now, rather than sort of feeding people one size fits all content, and the fact and no other choice, and then saying the fact they watch it suggests that they are in fact engaged. We now often make that choice, and we can measure what they really do and what they really want. And what we're discovering is that one size does not fit all. We are not as common a culture as we thought. The reason we know this is because we now measure the culture on a level never before possible. The 20th century model that I described, the 20th century mass media model, ended on a day that we can pinpoint with remarkable accuracy, and ended on this day. This is March 21st, 2000. This was the first day of spring of a new century. It was 3 days after the stock market crashed, the dot-com bubble. And it's the release of this album, which you can't really see very well here, but it's the second album of a boy band called NSYNC. This album is going to go down in history for a number of reasons. It launched the solo career of Justin Timberlake, who's a big pop star now. It probably wasn't sort of the high watermark of manufactured culture. There were 54 engineers who worked on this. It was completely manufactured. The music hit machine required hits and was becoming incredibly sophisticated at synthetic bands. And this is the ultimate synthetic band. It was, you know, the singers were picked carefully to fill different roles. Songs were written for them. It was produced by machines and engineers. And then this was their second album. Very ironically, the title, No Strings Attached, because of course it was entirely strings attached. They were puppets. But that's not why this album will go down in history. This album will go down in history because it was the last best-selling album. This was the best-selling when it came out. It was the best-selling. It was the best-selling album of all time in terms of its sales trajectory. It sold 2 million copies in its first week. Wanted to sell 10 million copies in that year, and it set a record. Now we didn't think much about it at the time because every year some album set a new record. That's what happens as industries fill up. But what we did not know then and do know now is this is the last one. This is what happened to the music industry. There, I may have a laser pointer here. Do I have a laser? Yes. So there, on March 21st, 2000, is the release of No Strings Attached. On that year, there were almost 1,200 albums that were gold, platinum, or multi-platinum. A million or more. And as you can see, they've been going up pretty much consistently since the 1950s. And then what happened after that is it fell down. And today, there are about 200 albums that go gold, multi-platinum, and they'll probably go to about zero. Maybe not exactly zero, but maybe it'll go to 10 in the future. In other words, we're going right back down to the bottom. Now, you would say, well, but that's not surprising. We know the music industry is in trouble. Well, that's actually not true. There's nothing wrong with the music industry broadly defined. There is more music being produced today and released than ever before in history. There's more music being listened to today than ever before in history, thanks to the increasing diversity of ways we have to listen to music, whether online, iPods, or whatever. Concerts are an all-time high. Concert revenues are at an all-time high. Merchandise is an all-time high. Licensing is at an all-time high. If you include the devices like the iPod and all other Apple devices as part of the music industry, it's never been bigger than it is today. There's only one part that has fallen off the cliff, and that is the hit album. That is the one-size-fits-all. That is the mass part of the culture. You know, there are still hits, for sure. There are still stars. But they are a shrinking fraction of the total industry. They no longer define the industry. They are the anomaly. The industry is defined by something else. And that is thousands and thousands of smaller bands, smaller hits, of more niche music, of more individual taste. What we're seeing is that it's not about the top 40 anymore. It's top 40,000, or top 400,000, or top 4 million. What we're seeing is a radical fragmentation of the marketplace. And the reason I use music is that it's simply a proxy. for what's going on everywhere else. Music was one of the first cultural products digitized. And because the file size was small enough that you could distribute on the internet, it was one of the first to take advantage of the infinite shell space of the internet and to reveal just how wrong we were about 20th century culture. When you give people infinite choice, they take that choice. This is not just true for music. This is some statistics from television. What you see here on the, this is the number of channels in the average American home, but it's true in most countries. And as we went from, when I was growing up in the 1970s, where we had three or four channels broadcast, to cable, to digital cable, high capacity digital cable, the average home in the West now has more than 100 channels. And as people get more channels, the average ranking of the top 10 shows is progressively gone. Now, once again, there's nothing wrong with television. One could argue that the golden age of television has never been better than it is today. There's certainly never been more television than there is today. If you measure the aggregate viewing hours, people are actually watching more television today than ever before. So there's more television being made, there's more television being consumed. What's happening? They're not all watching the same thing. The audience is once again fragmented. The reason the market share is going down is simply because there's more choice. You can watch different shows, you can watch different shows, some shows at different times, in different formats. You can watch it live. You can watch it live. You can watch it on TiVo, time shifted. You can watch it on Hulu, you can watch it on your iPad. You can watch it on DVD. You can watch other shows. With this many channels, you have no longer the need to watch what's on. You can find what's right for you and watch it when you want. So once again, we see this fragmentation of culture enabled by unlimited choice. As marketers, we are trained to look for the average consumer. And people keep asking us, what do most people want? What is the product that most people want? We are trained to look for the one size fits all. We're trained to find the hit. And so this is what's called a bell curve or a Gaussian distribution. And you sort of assume that the consumer taste looks like that. You try to find products right there in the middle. And then maybe they're a little adventurous. You might go out a little bit further and try to find a product that was out on the edges. But basically, it's all about the average. Well, here's the problem. There's no more average consumer. This is the wrong curve. The right curve looks like, the right curve doesn't look like that. Let's try that again. Okay. I don't know what's happened to the slides. So the right curve looks like this. What it looks like. It looks like a ski slope. This is the it's called a power law. It's called many names: Zipf, Pareto distribution. But it's the long tail. It's the long tail. And the reason this curve is not. Not new. This curve is completely familiar in the science world as the shape of nature. When you look at almost all natural phenomena, they distribute along this speech slope thing where you have a small number. So take, for example, cities. You have a small number of big cities. And then a large number of small cities. Or earthquakes. A small number of big earthquakes, a small number of big earthquakes, a large number of small earthquakes. Species are the same way. You have some species with huge populations, like ants, and a lot of big species with small populations, like polar bears. And the same is true for human taste. You have the hits, it's a small number of products that are very popular, and then you've got a large number of products that are not popular at all. And we generally just not sold the unpopular ones. But when you're addressing a global market, the notion of non-popular takes on a whole new meaning. And what we find is that it may not be popular in any one place, but when you aggregate a global audience, it becomes very popular. let me give you an example. So I lived in the United States, and soccer is not very popular in the United States. Should be. It's a great sport. Our kids play it, but professional soccer is not very popular. Nevertheless, there's a huge diaspora of people from other countries who live in the United States who would love to watch soccer. Not just have a the big matches, but all the matches. So there's an opportunity to serve them, but not on broadcast television. Likewise for cricket, another sport. Being outside the United States, not big in the United States, huge diaspora of people from the subcontinent, India, Pakistan, who would like to watch cricket, aren't able to do it. How do you serve this demand? You use a new distribution system. That distribution system is, of course, the internet. So I'm obviously going to sit past this. This data actually did show up. What we're finding is here's the data. What you're seeing is that the yellow bars here representing out of choice available. On internet marketplaces, this is music, and this is DVDs, and this is books. And typically, internet marketplaces will have 10 to 100 times more choice than a physical marketplace. And what you find is that when you offer people that much choice, their demand shifts. They go down the channel. And what you find is that in market after market, we see between a quarter and almost a half of the demand online is for products and services that are not available in traditional stores. This is true for cultural products, this is true for others, which we'll talk about in a minute. So what this tells us is that we were wrong about what people wanted. And as you inform people about their choices and give them tools to help make those choices, they increasingly become more individualistic. They increasingly need to sort of define themselves by the difference between them, between their taste and other people's taste, rather than the commonalities. They decide that one size fits all doesn't fit them. And what they want is something just right for them, and they're increasingly sophisticated about what that means. So the three rules are simply this. Number one, if you can lower the cost of distribution, you can offer more stuff. This is the basic rule of the internet. That it's got low cost distribution. And so, you know, in physical stores, we're constrained by the cost of shelf space. So take a Walmart, for example, a big retailer. A product has to sell at least two times per week in the average store to stay on the shelf. If it sells less than two times, it disappears. It goes off the shelf. If Walmart is your only lens on product variety, as far as you're concerned, when that product is off the shelf, doesn't make. But of course, Amazon doesn't have that rule, nor do any other internet retailer. They have infinite shelf space, so the products don't disappear. And even though they only sell twice a year, that's still a business. Now that's twice a year, not just in one store, but maybe just twice a year on the whole world. Now you would say that's a total failure. But what if you had 10 million products that sell twice a year? Then you've got, you know, 20 million sales. Well, then you just describe the emerging shape of the long tail of music and books, where they're increasingly digital goods. The cost of storing them is zero, or database entry. There's no reason to take them off the shelf. And those ones and twos and threes and fours add up when you can aggregate all the products in the marketplace. Second of all, if you can offer more variety, you can satisfy what people call minority taste. And minority taste is really the essence of the internet age. Minority taste is basically saying, you are unique. Your interests are not identical to anybody else's interests. And as a matter of fact, the things that define you as different may also define you most. That your specific interests, whether it be your family, your community, your hobbies, your cultural taste, your specific interests often matter more to you than your common interests of what you share as a Brazilian, a Chechenian, or an American. So, you know, for me, my specific interests might involve some kind of Lego robotics. You know, something I do with my kids, Lego robotics. There is no television show for Lego robotics. There's not on the radio anything about Lego robotics. But on the internet, there's a vibrant community about Lego robotics. And as a result, you know, I'm listening to my podcasts rather than listening to, you know, the radio that broadcasts. I listen to, like, a robotics podcast. I listen to very geeky thing. I don't expect you to share it. I'll bet each one of you has something like this, some very niche interest that is not served by radio and television, but is increasingly well served by this marketplace of infinite variety, which is the internet. And that's the kind of stuff that's maybe a little embarrassing, as in my case, but it really is stuff that's really you. It's something you really care about, and often you're willing to pay more for that. One of the interesting economic consequences of this is that when you look at the pricing of books on Amazon, the top 40 books are discounted by as much as 50%. As you go down the curve, things that are less and less popular, what you're finding is that the discount reduces to zero. In other words, the price goes up. And once you get way down the tail, the prices are really high. There's no discount at all. So what that says is that as you get more specific, people become less price discriminatory. They're saying, you know what, I really want this, and I don't care what it costs. So they'll pay more as you go further down the tail. Finally, there is a lot of stuff down the tail. When you define the tail as everything in our world that did not pass the test of retail distribution, traditional bricks and mortar, retail distribution, in other words, everything that did not make the shelf space of Walmart, then that is a lot. That is a lot. Because not only is it everything in any country that didn't pass the economic test of Walmart, but everything in any country, in aggregate, that didn't pass the test. Some of it was never commercial products in the first place. What is the internet today? But the explosion of the non-commercial. You know, the blogs, the social networks, the wikis, these aren't products from companies at all. And yet they share the marketplace with commercial products. So the everything else turns out to be a massive market, which is where we're increasingly going as a culture. So this doesn't just apply to digital goods. It actually speaks to something intrinsic to our species. So when I came out with the book, The Long Tail, I was surprised to see that America's largest beer maker, Anheuser-Busch, launched a new division called Long Tail Libations. Libations is sort of the English word for alcoholic drinks. And so I called him up and I said, what is the long tail of beer? How can there be a long tail of beer? And they said, they sent me three slides. And the first slide was this one. This is the product variety of Anheuser-Busch in 1997. And I feel like as an American, I need to apologize for all of this. This is sort of one size fits all beer. This is the Gilligan's Island of beer. These are Budweiser, Bud Light, etc. Very bland, very generic beers. They're not bland and generic because the beer company doesn't know how to make better beers. They're bland and generic because it needs to satisfy the commonalities of taste. It needs to be inoffensive. It needs to be the kind of thing that we all like enough to buy. We don't love it, but we like it enough. And only then can you come up with a product that will work in all markets, in all retail stores. And so this was sort of, this is sort of the top 40 of beers. Now let's fast forward to 2007, and this is the product variety. So what happened is that they started going down the tail. They came up with more minority taste. And so the long tail beer turns out to be microbrews and regional brews and beers that are not very good. They have stronger flavor. They're beers that you might hate, but someone else might like. And then ultimately, the final product is this, which is the world's first gluten-free beer for people who have gluten allergy. It's made with sorghum rather than wheat or barley. And it's worth just sitting here for a moment and focusing on this beer because it's just an amazing thing. You know, why now? Why did it take till 2007 to create the world's first gluten-free beer? Now, people have had gluten allergies forever. And the Egyptians were making beers from sorghum, not just wheat or barley. So why did it take till 2007 for a major beer maker to release the gluten-free beer? This has nothing to do with the internet, right? This beer being sold in stores. And the answer is simply this. We are getting more efficient at identifying minority taste. and distributing to minority tastes across the board, the revolution on the internet is paralleled by similar revolutions going on in traditional bricks and mortar retail, with point of sale terminals, just-in-time fulfillment, and affinity cards that track consumer preference. So what happened is that we're able to get more products instead of physical store. The number of SKUs, of shelf-keeping units, SKUs, in the average grocery store has doubled over the last decade. Not because the stores are any bigger, but because we are able to get smaller batches in the stores with just-in-time fulfillment. So by offering more choice in stores, we're also able to target the right products for the right demographics. So, you know, you don't have to have the same beer in every store. You can measure where the demand would be for that product and get just enough beers, not a pallet, but maybe just a case of those beers, and restock it very quickly. So we're starting to see the long tail play out in the real world as well. So let me give you another example. Shoes. There's Amazon recently bought a big shoe retailer called Zappos in the United States. And Zappos had, I think at last count, 150,000 different kinds of shoes. Now, no shoe retailer in the world can carry 150,000 different kinds of shoes, but there are 150,000 or more different kinds of shoes. So until we had e-commerce, we didn't have a way to service the choice that was actually out there, just not available to you in your local store. Now, one thing we're learning as we go down the tail and explore the notion of infinite choice is we're learning that more is different. What that means is that when you all go to 150,000 different kinds of shoes, what you discover, there are categories of shoes that you had no idea even existed. By getting more and more granular, you're identifying micro categories that are big enough to be markets of themselves. One of those micro categories is vegetarian shoes. I never heard of vegetarian shoes, but it turns out there is such a thing. Vegetarian shoes are shoes that have no animal products. There's no leather on the soles, and there's no other hides. This is the number one selling vegetarian shoe. It's a pink Converse sneaker with a canvas sole and a natural rubber bottom. Now, it's worth thinking a little bit about the consumer of the number one vegetarian shoe. We can guess by the color that it's probably a woman, probably a young woman. And because it's vegetarian, we can probably guess that they're socially conscious. So I think it's sort of like this, that the consumer here who thinks he's buying a vegetarian shoe is maybe a college student, a young, socially conscious woman who is very interested in things like working conditions. And this might be the exact same woman who is protesting Nike's working conditions and protesting sweatshop labor in Nike products. We see these protests all the time. Now, I've been to Nike factories, and I think their conditions are actually quite good, but it doesn't matter what I think. What matters is what she thinks. And she thinks that Converse is socially conscious and vegetarian, and that Nike stands for sweatshop labor conditions. What you may not know is that Converse is a 100% wholly owned subsidiary of Nike. And this is brilliant because what this allows Nike to do is to play in the head and to play in the long tail. Nike is able to use its mass brand to work through traditional retail and use its niche brands to work in non-traditional retail on the web. It has a top-down brand, which is marketed on television, and it has a bottoms-up brand, which gets its credibility, word of mouth, street culture. It's able to play on both sides by separating the brands entirely. And all the positive associations of Converse are not tainted by any of the mass, you know, market connotations of Nike, but Converse still benefits from Nike's distribution power. So playing on both sides of the curve is something that's becoming a very key to their 21st century skill. Bottoms up and top down. Mass and micro. So I want to give you one last example of the long tail work. This has to do with geography. This is something I know that, you know, that you think about a lot, which is the notion of, as we increasingly go to a globalized culture, there's this fear that's going to become dominated by, you know, by Hollywood or sort of, the mass media brands. And, 5 or 10 years ago, you hear a lot about media consolidation and the Disneyfication of all culture. And I know that, many vibrant national cultures worry that they couldn't compete with the, this kind of, the mass media machinery. And there's a Richard Florida did research about how the world is spiking, about how the sort of the big cities get bigger and the sort of the cultural and economic centers get more powerful. And that is certainly true, that cities and countries have a magnetic attraction that tends to make them bigger, called network effects. But and it's totally compatible, by the way, with long tail theory, that you do see fame snowballing into more fame and popularity leading to more popularity. But it's unlike the 20th century, where the blockbuster was the only story. In the 21st century, the blockbuster shares the stage with an unlimited number of niches. And so although it's still true that the world is spiking, what is not true is that it's okay not to be a spike. It's okay to be a smaller bit, a smaller city, a smaller market, because increasingly you have benefit of access to the global market. This is a map that shows the winners of the annual Google Programming Challenge. Every year, Google looks for the best programmers in the world. And these are the winners and where they came from. And what you see is you see the usual clusters around, the MITs, the Harvard, the Stanfords, the European schools. But what's interesting is the ones down here. Here's the ones from Brazil. And I think there's one from Ecuador. And there's one from the leaders in Chile. What you see is that there's talent everywhere. The talent is more widely distributed than our usual forms of finding the talent. Now, I live in Silicon Valley. I live outside of San Francisco. And the general presumption is that if you're going to hire an engineer, that engineer should go into the right schools, Stanford, MIT, would probably be the number one choice. They need to speak the right language, and they need to have the right educational background. That's sort of the rule, and you look for the correct form of filters, to find the right people for the job. Well, that I don't think is the rule anymore. When you see this, when you see a global talent search, you realize that we can't count on the spikes to indicate where the best talent is anymore. So this is my personal story. One of my side projects, I have a robotics company, and we do open source, unmanned aerial vehicles, drones. And I know that's relatively terrifying, but it's a fast-growing field. And when it came time for me to find my CTO, my partner to start the company with, I could go on the usual route, which is to go to MIT or Stanford and interview the graduates from the computer science department, the robotics department. But I didn't do that. What I did is I went online and I looked at the communities that were growing up around open source robotics and tried to see who the community thought was really awesome. And there was this one guy quickly rose to the top. His name was Jordi Munoz. And he was doing this amazing stuff like flying helicopters, Wii controllers. Unbelievable stuff. And I got in touch with him, and we started doing some projects together, and then we eventually decided to work together and start a company together. And at that point, I thought I should ask him a little bit about who he was. I never met him. So Jordi turned out to be a 19-year-old high school graduate living in Tijuana. And he'd never been to college. He really doesn't speak English that much at all. He would have failed the 20th century talent filter. I never would have found him. He didn't go to the right school. He wasn't born in the right country. He didn't speak the right language. He didn't have any of the credentials that a Silicon Valley success would normally have required. He didn't even come to Silicon Valley. He was still in Tijuana. But the point is that because He was working in a global marketplace, a marketplace of infinite shelf space, where the social filters recognized talent and merit regardless of where it came from and what language it spoke. I was able to find him. And now he lives in San Diego. We have company together. He is on the same on the cover of Make magazine. He is now kind of, you know, world famous as a roboticist, and as he should be, because he is the most talented person in this domain. And this, I think, is the long tail of people. And what it tells us is that you know, geography is no longer a barrier. What you can do will be identified, because we now have the social means to surface talent and to propagate it and to amplify success so it gets appreciated on a global scale. So there's that long tail that again you can't see. The question is now about money. And I want to end with sort of the second part of this, which is really asking the question, what are the business models around this? How do we actually I'm going to start really with what I'm doing right now, which is the iPad and the emerging tablet era. The first decade of the 20th century revealed some amazing truths about consumer preference. And we saw the emergence of the long tail, we saw the fragmentation of markets, and we saw the sort of the move away from one size fits all in mass media. What we did not see was very many business models built around it. Now, obviously, Amazon, the long tail stuff, makes money. And Google, the long tail information, makes money. And a small number of other retailers who are able to aggregate over the whole long tail, like eBay, made money. But for many others, it was difficult to make money. On the web, the only real business model we had, aside from e-commerce, was advertising. And the advertising-based model, it clearly hit its limits. There's just not enough online ad money to go around to fund every business. So the notion was that, okay, you can attract a long-tail audience with your niche blog on whatever it is, your retro fashion blog. You can get a very passionate audience, but you can't necessarily make a business because advertising requires volume. So, the advertising model didn't work, but as we're moving to these new mediums of mobile, and the iPad is part of mobile, we're moving to a different business model. It's not necessarily based on advertising. Instead, it's based on segmenting your market into those who free users and paid users. So I'm going to talk a little bit about it. We're right in the middle of it. I work for Condé Nast, which is America's the largest magazine publisher. And the tablet and the iPad in particular, I think it represents the future of media, and the future not only based on the engagement of these platforms, but business models around them. The reason I think that the tablets, and again I say tablet rather than just iPad, because I think you're going to see a range of tablets coming out over the next year based on Android and Linux and maybe even Windows as well as the iPad. The reason I think the tablet is going to be huge, in many ways sort of as big as mobile, in economic power, is three data points. First of all, the iPhone has taught us people do want rich media in their pocket. They do want a powerful application platform in their pocket. And what's interesting about the iPhone is that the business model there turned out not to be advertising, but instead actual sales, the apps. And these apps are not typically running. They're not typically running in a web browser. They're a standalone rich media application that's based on the freemium model, where you have a free version and a paid version. And most people use the free version, but it's a simple process to upgrade the paid version. And enough people do that, then it's a good business. The second data point is the Kindle. The Kindle is not a better way to read a book. It's arguably no worse for reading a book. But what it is a better way to get a book. It's a distribution model that allows you to distribute to get a book quickly, flexibly, whenever you want, at often a lower price. So the fact that people would buy a device simply to have a more flexible way to get books tells us that digital distribution of rich media is powerful indeed. And finally, there's the cloud. The rise of the cloud, and the more and more of our data in our lives live out there in Google, in Google Docs or Gmail or Google Calendar or wherever else your information lies. As more of it is out there rather than on your machine, the machines can be lighter, they can be have longer battery life, they're less powerful machines because they don't have to do all the work. Because they're connected to the internet, the work is in storage and the processing is going to be done out there in huge server farms. And therefore you're able to finally carry around a device that has the battery life, that has the size that you want. You don't have to carry your laptop anymore. And so the reason I think your tablet is going to be huge is not that it's going to compete with phones, but it's going to compete with notebooks. You're going to carry two devices with you as you do today. Today you carry your notebook and your phone. Tomorrow I think you carry your tablet and a phone. So that's just one device versus another. Why does it change the economics? And the answer is that if it follows the path of the iPhone, it's going to be an app platform. And on this app platform, it's based on paying for content. Everything is not received through a web browser. Because it's rich media, because it's possible to present a better experience in an app than you can present in a web browser, there's an opportunity here.